This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, the show that puts journalism and the media in the spotlight. This week, we have a selection of interesting stories from Asia Calling.
Let's start with the first two. Iram Sharmila broke her fast after a 16-year hunger strike, and Thailand has drafted a new constitution again.
Iram Sharmila, an Indian activist who has been on a hunger strike for 16 years, had her first taste of food last month. Demanding the repeal of a draconian law, Sharmila announced an end to her fast and her decision to continue her struggles through politics. Bismillah Gilani has the story.
Outside a hospital in Imphal, the capital city of the northeastern state of Manipur, 44-year-old Iram Sharmila is surrounded by a large gathering of supporters, policemen and journalists. One of Sharmila's supporters offers her honey in a cup. She takes a fingerful of it, and amid tears rolling down her face, she breaks her fast. This is how one of the longest hunger strikes in history came to an end. Sharmila announced her decision to end her protest a week ago, but both her supporters and critics were equally skeptical about whether she would actually do it. Sharmila had pledged to not take any food as long as the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, or the AFSPA, remained in effect. Detained for more than a decade under a law that makes suicide illegal, Indian authorities force-fed her through a nasal tube to keep her alive. Sharmila says it was her decision to begin the protest 16 years ago, and ending it today is also her decision.
This is my right. My right to suicide. Just see me just as an equal human being like others. Just as a human being who have all feelings of a mundane being.
Sharmila, however, made it clear that she is only giving up her hunger strike, not her struggle against the draconian law. Now she says she will continue to fight for her goal through electoral politics. Sharmila announced her intention to run as a candidate for Chief Minister, or CM, in her home state of Manipur.
I need power to remove the black law. I need power. And I want to be the CM of Manipur to make a positive change in sudden time. I know nothing about politics and about academic line also. My education is very, very low, but I want to convince our people that my power will shower upon people.
Sharmila was just 28 when she began her protest against the AFSPA in the year 2000. The AFSPA gives sweeping powers to Indian security forces, and critics say it has led to massive human rights abuses in India's northeastern states and the Indian-controlled Kashmir region. Sharmila's protest was instrumental in bringing national and global attention to the abusive impact of the law. But now, her decision to join mainstream politics has left her supporters divided. Ravi Nitesh is coordinator of the Save Sharmila Solidarity campaign. For years, he has been persuading Sharmila to end her fast and is now happy that she finally did it.
We welcome the decision of Sharmila. We will be with her, whether she will contest an election or not, whether she will win or she will lose or she will fight or she will not fight. All this doesn't matter. What matters is she is actually, despite her struggle of 16 years, she is ready to move forward this struggle through democratic ways, through peaceful ways, but its government that has adopted a hard line and that does not want to negotiate or to dialogue or to even adopt any flexibility in its approach.
a powerful symbol of resistance, scores of people from across the world expressed solidarity with Sharmila's struggle. In India, most political parties also welcomed Sharmila's decision, some even offering her membership and candidature. But many of Sharmila's ardent supporters, like Ongvi Chandrajini, questioned the wisdom of her decision.
We supported her because he was fighting against oppression. Now, if she joins politics and becomes part of the system, how can she then fight the state? Isn't it this the same system that he fought against all her life? How can she do this?
Some of Sharmila's family members have also expressed their disapproval of her decision. One radical group has even warned Sharmila against joining politics and marrying her fiancé, a British national who the group accuses of working for the Indian intelligence agencies. Sharmila, however, remains defiant.
People can't be convinced right now. And if they really don't want to change themselves, let them kill me the way people kill Mahatma Gandhi with the accusation of anti-Hindu, and the way killing Jesus Christ with their blood. Let them wash their dark emotions, their negative feelings towards me.
Sharmila's home state of Manipur will go to the polls next year. Whether her decision to join the fray will bring her any closer to what even the longest ever hunger strike could not achieve remains to be seen. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
It's amazing what some people do in order to fight for what they believe in. A 16-year fast. But what is so incredibly sad is that after she announced her decision to break her fast, move on to a different cause and take part in electoral politics, she was dumped by the people she has been fighting for years at the expense of her own life. She became homeless because nobody wanted to shelter her for fear of threats by insurgents who were upset by her decision. Can you imagine, Hanif? Okay, I don't agree with her method of a hunger strike, but at least she fought for the people in her own way. And then they just turned their backs on her in her time of need?
Yeah, it's kind of cruel. Personally, I feel like hunger strike is not really a good way to protest, as it harms you. But sometimes, you have to go that extra mile to drive the point home. Like you said, can you imagine not eating for 16 years? That's unbelievable, right? Sadly, the world is stubborn enough to not budge. But her efforts were not in vain, though. At least the world now knows her struggle. Some parties are not happy with her decision to join politics to continue her cause, but I think that that's the best channel for now, at least pragmatically. Thailand has voted an overwhelming yes to a new military-backed constitution, despite international concerns over a crackdown on democratic freedom. Almost 60% of voters turned out for the referendum last month to support the new charter, Thailand's 20th constitution since 1932. But critics say the new constitution only extends more power to the military-led government. Asia Calling's Kanika Pechkau has the story from Chiang Mai.
It used to be very crowded here in Bosang, a handicraft village in northern Thailand, famous for its paper umbrellas. Now the major tourist attractions are empty. The coup appears to have had a quieting effect. Ong Ad is a vendor in his 50s. He started his business a decade ago, hoping he could start a better life for his family. But these days, he tells me, especially after the political coup 2 years ago, he hardly makes a penny. That's Vipu Thalang. He is in his 60s now. I met him here in Chiang Mai. When he paid a visit to the family of the local politician, detained for violating the Referendum Act. A former MP who lost his job when the military took over in the coup in 2014. Vipul Thalang knows politics when he sees it. And the junta played years of civil unrest to its advantage, he accused.
People were just sick of the unrest, the street demonstrations, the chaos. They didn't see that all those incidents were a conspiracy plan to legitimize the coup and undemocratic rule.
Like many other politicians, Vipul Thalang was detained right after the coup and now lives under surveillance. He's also barred from all political activities. After taking power in 2014, Thailand's interim military-backed National Council for Peace and Order, or NCPO, led by General Prayut Chan-o-cha, has stifled the media and banned political gatherings. Ahead of the referendum vote, political rallies and open discussion about the new constitution were banned, and criticism of the draft was made punishable by 10 years in jail. When their own act says the environment was tightly controlled.
In the last referendum in 2006, we were allowed to study all the content and participate with our ideas. But this one is just a seat full of manipulation.
The military-backed government has said the new constitution is a major step toward a fully functional democracy and healing more than a decade of divisive politics and civil unrest. Yet, the new constitution also designed a seat for the military in the parliament. A move rights groups say will give the military more power now, as well as guarantee its influence in Thai politics well into the future. Even still, junta head General Prayut has promised general elections will go ahead next year.
The new constitution is a sign of a new election coming next year. In the meantime, the government and you, the people, still have a mutual obligation to the country's security and development. A big obligation awaits. It's the hope and the survival of this country. It is the country's reform.
Even though the turnout was lower than expected, almost 60% of voters chose the new constitution. But here in Thailand, some people felt that voting no wasn't really an option. Long-time social critic Pipop Udom Wittipong explains.
The dangerous thing is they start to trample down on people who cast the no vote. That's pretty dangerous because, as you can see, that majority of the people in the north and the northeast, because they feel they have been suppressed, they feel frustrated under the military rule. That's very clear.
Thailand's north has historically been a stronghold of the Red Shirt camp. Supporters of former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, who was ousted by the junta 2 years ago. The other camp, known as the Yellow Shirts, are more closely aligned to the military and urban elites in the capital. Despite the government's claims, Pipop says the referendum will only fuel more frustration and division, especially among many in the north who didn't support the junta to start off with.
The thing is, can we say that, you know, all this grudges, all this frustration, all this sense of depression, are they gone? No, they're not. They are still there, you know. They are simply made latent by the strong grip of power, by the strong repression.
And what's the long-term effect of that? Here's Pipop's take.
It will explode. That wouldn't be nice. We have seen it in 2010. We have seen it 1992, longer than that. And it never turned out very nice. It turned out very ugly. And that shouldn't happen again. We shouldn't repeat the same mistake.
For Asia Calling, this is Kanika Petkao from Thailand.
Thailand's constitutional change and coups seems to be cyclical these days. If you want to look at it from a different perspective, that's a sign of a healthy democracy. And I'm referring only to the constitutional change here, not the coups. The number of coups they had might turn some people off, actually, and deter them from participating in the democratic process. People want a semblance of stability. And maybe, to them, backing the military is the way to go for sustainable order and peace. I'm saying this with air quotes, by the way.
And I can confirm that air quotes were actually used. I agree with you, Hanif. It seems that Thailand's numerous coups don't really help the country move towards democracy. This is despite the Thai military saying that the new constitutional change promotes democracy as it eliminates corruption. So it's a question of, what, one evil for the greater good? Up next, more stories from Asia Calling. I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
Let's continue our journey across Asia by heading to Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, thousands of Afghans are making their way home after decades living as refugees in neighbouring Pakistan. For many of these refugees, their own country is now a foreign place. From the capital, Kabul, Shadi Khan Saif has the story on the long road of integration ahead.
For years, migration has left deep marks on the lives of Afghans, so much so that this national grief is often reflected in Afghan folk songs. Years of war in the country, initially sparked by the Soviet invasion in the 1980s, forced millions of Afghans to flee the country. Many more followed when the country plunged into a deadly civil war in the 1990s, and then during the oppressive regime of the Taliban in the mid-1990s. Roughly 3 million Afghan refugees living in Pakistan now have only 4 months to pack up and return to their war-torn country for good. From the beginning of this year, a record 30,000 refugees said goodbye to Pakistan due to mounting persecution and uncertainty surrounding the legal status of their stay. Pakistan extended their stay at the last moment, but only for 6 months, with a warning of no more extension. Nadir Farhad, a spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, explained some other reasons behind the sudden surge in the number of refugees returning.
In the last month alone, we saw a large number of refugees return because of the increased stipend and growing persecution in Pakistan. Each returning refugee is now paid $400, so a family of, let's say, 5 members can get up to $1,000.
In the past, the refugees were only paid around $200, hardly enough to even cover the transportation costs. While thousands have now decided to return to Afghanistan, most have no idea what they will do next. Tila Muhammad, a father of four, spent 25 years as a refugee in Pakistan and has now returned literally empty-handed.
Look at my hands. With these bare hands, we are working in this open field to erect a mud house for the children to live in. Both the governments, Afghanistan and Pakistan, promised us help and facilities, but we haven't got anything except the money given to us on arrival by the UNHCR.
The story of Tila Muhammad is shared by almost everyone repatriated back to Afghanistan from Pakistan. Deprived of many basic facilities in Pakistan, they lived a life of compromises and sacrifice. Malik Siddiq, an elderly Afghan who migrated to Pakistan during the 1980s, says it doesn't look much different now.
We were called refugees throughout our stay in Pakistan, and now as we have returned, people are saying the refugees have returned. The government did not consult us and decided our repatriation. In all those years, many women become widows and children became orphans. They should have been warmly welcomed back home, but this is not the case.
Almost every returning family claims to have paid thousands of rupees to the Pakistani border forces to allow them carry their wood, animals, trunks, utensils and other goods across the border. Many parts of modern-day Pakistan, including the whole of northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and many districts of southwestern Balochistan, were part of the Greater Afghanistan before the British rule over India. An overwhelming majority of the Afghan refugees are ethnic Pashtuns, meaning they share an ethnic lineage with their Pakistani hosts. Analyst Tahir Zalan believes the refugee bore the brunt of cold ties between the two countries that worsened after cross-border skirmishes last month.
Eventually, it's a good thing that these refugees return to their home country. But the government and the aid agencies should create a better environment for them to integrate and overcome the early problems.
The Afghan government has promised to provide land to each repatriated family. In Kabul, land has already been designated for the refugees in four areas, but the allocation process is slow and complicated. Even still, some, like Daulat Khan, a recently repatriated Afghan, are happy to be home.
Thank God, it is our own country. One can die with honor in one's own land. In a foreign land, even a prince is not actually a prince.
For Asia Calling, this is Shadi Khan Saif in Kabul, Afghanistan.
That, in essence, is the life of a refugee, isn't it? You have to leave your own country, and when you do return someday, you are treated like a persona non grata. If you put that aside, you'll still find assimilation a problem, since the country that you've left behind might not be the same when you return. Sadly, it seems like the situation is, once a refugee, always a refugee. It shouldn't be that way. Society should play a bigger role in integrating these refugees back to normalcy. That's the least we can do for them.
I hope that the Afghan government makes good on its promise to give land to the recently repatriated Afghan families. It's the least the government can do for its own citizens who are in dire need of aid.
India has the largest number of child labour worldwide. The government recently introduced a new law, which it claims will go a long way to prevent this practice. But rights activists are worried that it might just do the opposite. Bismillah Gilani has the story.
The Ghazipur landfill site on the outskirts of Delhi is the city's largest garbage dump. Dozens of men, women and children with large sacks on their backs are rummaging through the heaps of waste here to find recyclable trash. Among them is 9-year-old Parul, who is helping her mother fill her sack.
This is not an easy job. We really work hard. I help my mother in the kitchen as well. But this is our real work, and we all do it, including my father and brother. I also help my brother load the sacks on the bicycle.
A few kilometers away, in the narrow back streets of Okhla, 12-year-old Majid ekes out a somewhat similar meager living from a garment factory.
I get up early, take a bath and begin my work. My father and mother also work here. I don't get enough food. I want to become a rich man. I want to buy my mother a fan so that she gets some relief from the heat in summers.
According to India's Right to Education Act, both Parul and Majid should be in school, receiving a free education and a midday meal. But instead, millions of children in India are put to work, say child rights activists. Komal Ganotra is a policy director at the NGO Child Rights and You, or CRY. She describes the situation as catastrophic.
There is a whole country within this country that is engaged in child labor. The sheer number tells you what we as a country are in for. If you broaden the age group to 6 to 18 years, we have 33 million child laborers. This is a human capital, a precious resource for this country. And if it goes without education, you can imagine what we are heading to.
Activists have for long pinned their hopes to the new law for prevention and regulation of child labor to turn the situation around.
Objective of this act is total eradication of child labor. And
the parliament recently passed some radical amendments to the law, which the government claims would enable it to effectively eradicate all forms of child labor. But activists like Nobel laureate Kailash Satyarthi are not convinced.
There is relaxation for employing children.
He is particularly concerned about two provisions. One that allows children to be employed in works their families are also engaged in. Second, that trims down the list of what are known as hazardous occupations, in which children under any circumstances are not allowed to work.
There are very, very serious grey areas. We have rescued more than 3,000 child laborers below the age of 14 between 2010 and 2014. And 21% of these child laborers were working in so-called family enterprises, in those informal sectors, what they call the home-based industries or home-based occupations.
He says the new law threatens to undo even the gains made through the past decade and ensures further victimization of children.
It is modern day slavery, I would say, because most of these children are victims of trafficking and bonded labor system. And primarily, the children are preferred to the adults because they are the cheapest source of labor. They could be forced to work long hours a day, sometimes 18 hours a day. So it's virtual slavery. They are not working freely. It is not a fun for them. It is some sort of force on them to work in those conditions.
The United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, or UNICEF, has also expressed concern about the law, saying it would make children more vulnerable and force most of them into labor. But the government brushes aside these fears as unfounded. Tarun Vijay is spokesperson for the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP.
The best guarantee of security a child gets is from parents, from family. If we destroy the family and the parents in the name of some kind of regulations, we've ruined the life of the child. Not the child labor activist, not the UNICEF people, and not any other member of parliament. Nobody loves his child more than the parents. This provides a proper protection to the children. The punishment to the offenders have been doubled, and the parents have been secured because they have to see that this also creates a good congenial atmosphere in the family between the child and the parents.
The law is now in effect, but analysts say the law alone might not be enough to fight the scourge of child labor. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Enacting a law is a step in the right direction, but doing that alone is sometimes not enough. We have to have a little bit more foresight to be able to recognize potential loopholes. In this instance, the part that allows children to be involved in family business will definitely be abused. Yes, I understand that some families sincerely see that as a way to train and discipline their kids, which is fine, if you want to stretch it. But I'm a firm believer in putting your kids through proper education first, before even thinking about grooming them to be your successor.
Exactly, Hanif. Children are often just exploited under the guise of being involved in a family business. It's exploitation just the same, especially if the children aren't allowed to go to school. It's not a question about them not being privileged enough and having to work to support their family. It's about breaking that cycle by providing them with an education to better themselves. I too am a firm believer in educating children to give them the tools to better themselves. Indonesia's first president was a famous art lover. Over his lifetime, Sukarno collected more than 2,000 works of art by both Indonesian and international artists. But he wasn't just a collector, he was also a painter. After decades of being locked inside the presidential palace, Sukarno's collection is now on display. Ria Apriyani met the exhibition curator to find out more.
Dressed in a green kebaya, a traditional Javanese blouse, brown batik and a flower in her left ear, a beautiful and mysterious portrait is now on display at the National Gallery in Jakarta. Rini was captured in a painting by Sukarno in 1958. Exhibition curator Miki Sesanto says no one knows for sure who she is.
Who is the real Rini? It is said that it was his nanny called Serena. For Sukarno, Serena was representative of women from that era.
Serena played an important role in Sukarno's life, even warranting a mention in his book. But the painting of Rini has made people curious about the symbol, the woman behind the painting, says Mike.
Symbols can be interpreted in many ways. Sukarno had the ability to give particular meaning when he did something.
So far, Mike has discovered 15 works by Sukarno. The paintings, along with Sukarno's art collections, were kept safe at the palace, while other works were stored by his friends or went with him in exile. But Rini has been displayed at the presidential palace for decades. Much of Sukarno's art collection has been held under lock and key at the palace for years. But this August, the collection made its debut at the National Gallery in the capital. Of the thousands of pieces in the collection, 28 were chosen by the curator to illustrate Indonesia's fight for independence. The exhibition includes works from 22 artists and, of course, Sukarno. Sukarno believed the walls of the presidential palace should be filled with art. But while he happily solicited works, he wasn't always willing to pay for them, as well-known Indonesian expressionist painter Afandi once discovered. Here's Mike again.
Pernah suatu kali Afandi itu ke Gedung Agung.
There was one time when Afandi came to the presidential palace and asked that his debt be settled. Sukarno was confused because he didn't have any money, and he offered Afandi a presidential pen with President Sukarno's name carved on it. But Afandi refused. Then Sukarno gave Afandi him and his wife's used clothing, a sack of rice, and a presidential physician. At the time, Afandi had asked for money so that he could seek medical help for his sick wife.
Besides buying art from known painters, Sukarno also hunted down art during his travels abroad. One of the prize pieces in his collection is a painting entitled Malay Girl with Flower by famous Mexican artist Diego Rivera.
Lukisan itu didapat oleh Presiden Sukarno ketika berkunjung ke Mexico dan modelnya.
The painting was obtained during a presidential visit to Mexico. The model was a diplomat's wife, Ancha Effendi. She was prompted by her husband, Bose Effendi, to be painted by Diego Rivera. At the time, she was expecting her second child.
While many works have survived over time, curator Mika Sesanto says that thousands have been damaged by natural conditions, like the tropical climate. The Indonesian government has struggled to find funds to maintain the paintings, which is why Mika advised that other parties be engaged to help.
Those artworks that were neglected, it was due to the limited budget and staff. I mean, the ministry has to be a partner. The restoration can't only be left to the civil servants.
Even though it was left for years, the collection remains a priceless part of Indonesian history. For Asia Calling, this report was produced by Ria Apriyani in Jakarta.
I had no idea about Sukarno being an avid art collector or his artistic abilities. Right now, though, there is much controversy over the art items he collected. Does the art, which is housed at the presidential palace, belong to the government or to Sukarno's family?
That's a good question. For me, I'm not surprised to hear that Sukarno was a fan of paintings. I was told that paintings are able to calm you down, so being a leader that he was, he definitely needed that. And I can imagine a visionary like him needing a blank canvas to pour his ideas out in an abstract and subjective way, which is what he did.
Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. To download the podcast, head on over to bfm.my/icymi.
I hope it's been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.